today, the title of this, whatever it is Truth and Dare. Dare. I have to explain this word. Thank you for reminding me. Who can explain? I think it'll be, we'll need more than one language. I think. To do something that's scary or challenging or risky to do. Something out of the ordinary for you. Beyond what's comfortable for you.
Take a chance.
What would be a good?
Give
take a chance.
Courageous gamble.
Courageous gamble, yeah. Okay.
Huzzah.
Sounds good.
I remember in my childhood there was a children's game that we used to play, and it was called Truth or Dare.
Exactly. Do you have this game anywhere other than the United States?
Yeah.
Truth or Dare? So, Truth or Dare? We could play it now if you want. Okay, M.A.G., Truth or Dare?
I know the rules.
You're going to see it in action.
I just warned you first that the dare is going swimming in the lake.
I'm asking you Truth or Dare.
Okay.
We'll explain, don't worry. So Truth or Dare? So, she chose truth instead of dare.
I'll choose dare.
Too late. So the first part of the game is you have to choose either truth or dare. And then the person who's asking the question, who would like to ask the question?
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
I want to.
Truth. What was the most embarrassing moment in the last? Either in your life, if you dare, or in the last few years, the most embarrassing moment.
I've got a really ridiculously high embarrassment threshold.
That's great. So it's easy for you then. Luckily.
I can get the last few days.
Okay.
Like.
Now. I'll explain, don't worry. We won't leave you out. So, the second step of the game is the person who's asking truth or dare has to, so she chose truth, so I get to ask any question I want, and she has to tell the truth. That's the rule. So the question was, what's the most embarrassing moment in whatever time frame you choose? And she said, well, yesterday when Ajay said to the whole group that Emma G loves to read all those horrible women's magazines. Which she said, no, I didn't say that. So that's how you play truth or dare. The dare part would be if I would say truth or dare to you, and you would choose dare, then I would say, I could tell you to do anything and you have to do it. And so Emma G was saying, for example, go jump in the little pond there. So we won't have to go that far. Yeah.
I thought you asked the question first, and then if you're too scared to answer that particular question, you have to do the dare.
So this is for non-daring people. We also did this sometimes when the people were too rough in the group. Then you can first either say what the dare is or say what the question is, and then the person can decide. So let's say the question is, what was the most embarrassing moment of your life? And you say, I'm not going to answer that, so I go for the dare. Okay, so this is one modified version of the game. Yeah? It doesn't matter so much, but it's a good game when you're about 13, basically. So, recently, I was recovering physically from something and staying with some friends in Delhi. Gemma and I were staying with these friends in Delhi who are around 70. And they were going through an intense, also, time in their lives. And so Demogee went out to the market and got some really trashy movies for us to watch together. Which was great. Which was a great service. So we were sitting with our friends who are like Reiki masters and teachers for Sri Sri Ravi, like this guru in India, and you know, considered elderly, whatever, they're not really, but, and watching these horrible Hollywood movies, like Wedding Crashers, if you've ever seen them. And they loved it. It was a great experience. And one of the movies we watched was this Madonna film, Truth or Dare. And it's a film, guess what, about her. And it's called Truth or Dare. And towards the end of the film, so she has a camera follow her around for I don't know how long, not very long, a couple of years maybe. Supposedly everywhere, but not you can see it's not really everywhere. She always looks great. She's never working out, also, etc. So towards the end, they play this game, Truth or Dare. She and her sort of staff, well, they're her dancers, really. And basically, as it does when you're 13 and you play the game, eventually you start to gravitate towards basically exposure. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, obviously the game is all about that, really. Exposing something, some of your personal story, or exposing some of your body, basically. So they did that. Probably much more of the body than that. But if we're exposing personal story, the question is that really exposing? And if I'm exposing my body in that way, is it really exposing? So in the Madonna way, maybe some of you have had the grace never to have heard of her or whatever, but she's pretty amazing person, I think. But it seems to me that her way of exposing is not really exposing. Exposing so on purpose and hard that it's not really exposure. It's a way of non-exposing. And similarly, if we're trying to expose our deep, dark secrets and our story, I just wonder, I'm not saying like yes or no about this, I just wonder if I expose my story to you, how much is that really naked? How naked is that really? So sometimes we consider it to be a deep conversation if we expose ourselves. If I expose my story, you expose your story. And sometimes that can be a deep conversation. Sometimes that's the best medicine in the world, just to be heard or to be seen. But I think it really easily falls, we get gravitated towards this human fascination, that kind of, you know, way even before 13 years old, but coming to a peak around whatever age, 14, about exposing, about nakedness, and the power of nakedness. And how do I approach that power? How do I handle that? What do I do with that? And sometimes we approach it trying to escape it. Not really approaching it. So I'm talking about us here on this retreat. I'm not really talking about Madonna and my friends in Delhi and being 13. But I like to leave a lot of things for you to discover, so feel confused and feel free to ask questions also. But I actually want to maybe almost on purpose bring some confusion in by reading the poem that's really meant for the end of this talk at the beginning. And this poem is called The Gift, which is the title poem of this book called The Gift. Of poems of Hafiz. We met a wonderful Iranian guy this summer. Hafiz. So now I try to say it the right way. Our union is like this. You feel cold, so I reach for a blanket to cover our shivering feet. Shivering. a hunger comes into your body. So I run to my garden and start digging potatoes. You ask for a few words of comfort and guidance. I quickly kneel at your side, offering you this whole book as a gift. You ache with loneliness one night so much you weep, you cry. And I say, here's a rope. Tie it around me. Hafiz will be your companion for life. And what this poem has to do with nakedness or honesty. We've been talking a lot about honesty these days. I found myself from the very beginning of my trying to meditate life, a sense of when I'm meditating feeling, exposed. Feeling that I wouldn't like to be seen while I'm really meditating. Afraid of if I go so deep and someone would see me while I'm that deep inside myself. As partly a way of not going deep also. But nothing that I could do about it, I found so far. Sometimes I just feel that exposed. And I wonder what we could do about this. Because we're here together trying to meditate. And for some people, it's just pretty claustrophobic in the rooms and even in the tent, which compared to some of our other retreats. By the way, warning, is really spacious. And not only in India, like in Spain, you would not believe what we made people go through. And then in Israel, instead of having to separate the group into two halls, because there was a mistake about letting how many people on, and they let 40 people extra on the retreat. Oops! So a couple of friends, including someone here, actually went into the hall with masking tape and measured the floor and marked. Maybe that would have been helpful here, some of you are thinking. This is how much space you have. A yoga mat is how much space you have.
Yoga mats is big.
That's true. Some yoga mats are bigger than what the space we had for each person in Israel. And the amazing thing was people went for it. So how can we find a way of being that exposed to each other inescapably all the time, whether we have physical space or not, we're that exposed? And how can we manage to keep going along with our life? What we usually do is there's this other children's thing, the emperor's clothes thing, if you know this story. Where someone who is called us is told, here's a beautiful new suit made with all of the best threads from Tunisia or whatever, just for you. And you feel like you can't admit that you don't see anything there. So you put it on. So it's important to know what we put on, thinking that it's actually non-nakedness, thinking that it's covering something. And it's important how we approach each other, knowing the fact of our nakedness, the fact of our having this much space all the time next to each other. the fact of our vulnerability to each other. The fact of our, in so many ways, not actually being safe in the way we would love to be. Actually not being safe. Physically, for example. Just a small example. The only thing that we can say that we definitely all share is the fact that we are going to die, for example. So this is can contribute to our nakedness and claustrophobia, or could contribute to our being willing anyway to go along with our life without knowing exactly what we're doing. So it's important, I think, to notice what we're trying to show to each other and to ourselves. So one of my friends, who's a comedian in Holland, talks about what's in our shop window. What is the window dressing? Who do we think we are? This is important. It's not that we're not that. That may be considered part of what we are. But it's important to know what I think you see about me or what I see about me. It's important to know that. So I have a friend, a great friend with a huge heart, who has in his shop window negativity, not liking things, hating India and coming every year so that he can really hate India. I hate India. Don't you hate India? The mosquitoes, the diarrhea, etc. The dust, the noise. And so it's also important to know what is not in the shop window, but is actually in the shop, let's say. What is there that we're not showing, we think. We think we're not showing. So this particular friend, his huge heart totally shows. Even when he's hating India. I remember driving in a jeep up to this just gorgeous place on the Ganga, on the Ganges River. Morning sun coming over the mountains, flashing on the green river. And I was just like, oh. And then I sort of turned to him and he was like, I hope we're getting there soon. This is terrible. Are we almost there? Such a bumpy, dusty road. But even in that moment, like, this huge heart. I have another friend who was very much aware of feeling fear, especially with other people. And trying to feel her way into how that fear works. What it is and how it works. What its shape is. And she described it so delicately and beautifully, saying, it seemed to be a shield, but also my actual experience was that it was asking from people something. So there was a sense of a shield somehow, but then actually my fear of what you think of me, for example, my fear that you will not like me or whatever, can seem to be a shield, but in fact is a demand that you like me, for example. I'm asking, begging, please. Which doesn't sound exactly only like fear. Or is interesting to know that fear can work like that. But she didn't stop there and kept investigating. Right. She said, and I love that fear. What great honesty. This is what no one can dare to say. No one can dare to say, I love that fear that I hate. And And I almost mean literally no one can say that. No one can actually be there and see that clearly at the same time. So clear. And she kept going. Woo! She noticed that this did form a kind of bond, she said, with people. Not the kind of bond or connection that can happen in openness, in her experience. But it did function as a person. It did function as a way of interacting. It did make a bond. So we can manage this way. We do manage this way. But we also have this knowing of what happens when there's openness and connection. Nakedness and intimacy. When we come to meditation, very, very often, we can come with more interest in truth or more interest in dare. And many people who love meditation are more interested in truth, which we'd like to give a big T, a capital T, so that we can feel more special. I'm seeking the truth, therefore, leave me alone. Don't bother me with your real life stuff. In fact, don't bother me with life at all. Actually, is what we mean. Don't bother me with that mess. And I'm afraid how easily we can assume that we're meditating when we're really hiding. I'm afraid of this. And how long we can go on doing that. How many decades we could go on doing that. Or how many even long seconds. Whatever. Another person who had the courage to keep looking on this retreat was talking about the feeling of that openness that sometimes comes, the feeling of expansion, being bigger than who I thought I was, and how it doesn't usually mention in those big T truth books. She didn't say this part, but I'm saying. Doesn't usually mention in those books about truth how terrible it is to be in that space, that open, that vulnerable. Wonderful also, but absolutely threatening and scary. So she noticed one day, that open, that vivid, that alive, that tender, that not knowing. And then feeling like, there's a kind of meaninglessness coming up, she said in her experience. And we just checked into that experience of meaninglessness that was coming into a space of aliveness and vividness. And what she found out was that that thought about meaninglessness was a very nice, very kind of even graceful, respectable and intelligent escape from being that wide open. really good ways of escaping. And it's so important to be that caring and soft and feeling into our experience what's going on. And sometimes what sounds like truth from a book is an escape from truth in the life. Did I say sometimes? It's important that we find a way that we could keep exposing the way we lie to ourselves without forceful exposure or without exposing Madonna style as a show for no one knows who. This is probably, well, it's so important. And it's something to learn experientially. How softly we can go without giving up. How long we can wait without turning sour. Sometimes the quality is like being in a place that you know a wild animal could come in the morning by the water, for example, and becoming invisible there, but being there. And not demanding that the animal comes either. But when the animal comes, sometimes we're not ready, even though we're waiting for it. It's too amazing, too alive, too itself, too different from this book, truth. So I'm talking about even seeing things like irritation or boredom or restlessness or sadness or whatever. Even waiting by the pond in the early morning to see that. And even when that's what we see, even if it does match what they say in the books about anger and whatever, those friends. There's something so much more alive about that meeting in the morning by the lake, where it's so alive that it's almost like, am I really seeing this? And then it goes, and it's kind of like, did I really see that? Have you ever had that happen with a wild animal? Sometimes I have to really, you saw that, right? The person next to you, you know. Or you go and look for the tracks. Yes. So even if it matches my expectation, it's so different from what I expect when it's in that alive, fresh morning moment. And even when it's just anger suddenly coming out of nowhere, crashing through the forest. Isn't it amazing how much power suddenly is there from where? So even like these really ordinary experiences that we would love to transcend and get here, it's a big truth. We can see reflected a kind of power. And it's interesting, I find it's interesting to notice, where does that power come from exactly? So if we keep even just with anger. Anger came crashing in. And it's easy to find a reason to be angry. If anger wants to come in, it's easy to find reasons. First of all, we could notice, did anger just need to come crashing in and then I found a reason to be angry? In some subtle way, we could just check that. And then if I connect to the experience of wild animal hatred or irritation. Is there also some power to the seeing, the receptivity? Anger could come, it could have a kind of forcefulness in it. But it seems to me that sometimes we can just see anger or any other cow, any other animal. And something about the way that we're receiving or meeting or seeing makes it possible to notice that there's a huge amount of power there. And that power has some relation to me as an individual. And it also is not mine. So just notice sometimes if you're, let's say, really tired. And maybe, because when we're traveling, usually the ultimate state is to be in a state of been there, done that. I already went there. Yeah, I know there's a German bakery in Tijuana. Okay. Yeah, I went to Goa. I've been to Goa now, I can say. For the first time in however many years of coming to India. 20 years of coming to India. I've been to Goa, yeah. So, even if we're in the total cool, done everything, seen everything, not interested in anything or anyone, anger comes, and we're a different person. There's a different situation, and we're very awake. Where does that energy come from? Where? Sometimes we want to do meditation so that we don't have to deal with those animals. We don't like our angry self. So we meditate. We don't like our fearful self, so we meditate. We don't like our lonely self, so we meditate. My back already hurts. I'm not gonna do that. So let's be careful about that. So we're not just going for truth. Or if we go for truth, we need to notice if there's some dare in the truth, some courage in the truth. Similarly, other people come to meditation not caring about the books, just liking to break the rules. Just being the daring one, doing the dare without the truth, which eventually can be boring, but let's not sort of wait 40 years to find out how boring that is, to be special by breaking the rules. To feel a kind of image of nakedness or an image of intimacy by saying, I don't care what you think, like this. It's boring. It's important for us to dare to see. Sometimes we may have a feeling of wanting to be seen, and we go to different teachers with hope and fear that that teacher will really see my deepest core, will really expose me to myself. And sometimes this could be helpful. Sometimes this could be happening in a loving way. But just questioning the way we're looking for that being seen. What am I really wanting in that being seen? Am I wanting some kind of confirmation of my specialness? So looking for individual specialness is this kind of Madonna exposing. I think that knowing that we do need to be seen, that we are seen, that there's nothing stopping us from being seen, no clothes. I think that our approach could be rather daring to see. So daring to see anything as it is, including me. So let's say it's not anger that I'm looking at, but a leaf. Like on a tree. A leaf, yeah, one leaf. So I'm not even playing truth or dare in the sense of exposing my story that I'm an angry person behind my beautiful shop window. I'm just looking at a leaf, one leaf. And sometimes it may be possible for that magic to happen, where it happens that the leaf enters, or I enter, or I am, or that is. Yesterday in the, I think it was yesterday, in the Mira poem, she said something that I think none of us would necessarily agree to without reading the contract first. She said, I will not dress myself the way I want to dress myself, but the way my sahib wants to dress me. So, having been hurt, and having been actually hurt, we are afraid of someone telling us what to do, especially something so close as my clothing. And so I don't think that Mirabai was saying, let people tell you what to do. Let another person in the morning go and decide what shirt you're going to wear. But I do think that we could question the ways that we dress ourselves and why. And in the West, one of the very funny, well, let's say in the United States specifically, probably more than in Europe, there's extra clothing in the sense of what car do you drive? And I'm a person who never in my life owned a car. So I'm always wearing someone else's car if I'm driving it. And it's so funny what people assume. When I drive my stepmother's station wagon with the church decal on the back window, or my friend's beat up, huge, gas guzzling, horrible, you know, Ford, whatever it is, four wheel drive down the street. Ridiculous. And people could look and say, look at that person in that terrible anti-environment car. And I'm like, hi. So this is partly what I mean about helping each other with the emperor's clothes. It's like seeing through the car window. Maybe the person loves the car. and they are wearing the car. Or the meditation cushion, backpack, whatever. Group of friends, etc. I think that we tend to take everything that we do as a communication of who my individual is. What I individually want to express. We tend to think that that is what life is. Being authentic is feeling what my individual wants to communicate to your individual. Madonna. I really don't want to seem that I'm really putting Madonna down, because in this department, considering how the culture is, I think she's doing a good job at bringing this to a peak and also questioning it through the back door. But we could also go a little further, I think. Who is it that would dress us? That we would happily not just necessarily throw away all of our clothes. They can stay there on the floor under the bed or whatever, in the backpack, in the closet, whatever. Maybe life chooses one of those shirts that you bought, that you like today. I think that this is one part of the feeling embarrassed to be alive, that we can actually slowly soften and even resolve. If I feel that everything that I wear or say, every person that I am seen with, every car that I am seen in, every book or every piece of food that is seen near me, if that is seen, is taken as me, as an expression of who I really am, then I will have to be embarrassed, even if I've chosen carefully every single thing. And since I haven't. So I think we could help each other in this way. Not taking everything as a deliberate communication about a person, about one person. And if what I do and say and wear, etc., and eat and all of these things, is not only a communication about me, is not even primarily a communication about me, then what? So, there's something called the sphincter law, and I will tell you what a sphincter is, don't worry.
Please don't.
I'm definitely not intending to show you it. Although, I don't even know, maybe that's one in there somewhere. Let's see if I can try to see. When you have to pee, and you don't pee, but you have to pee, you're tightening a sphincter to hold the pee inside the body. Okay? Okay. So what is the sphincter law? There's a woman who has been a midwife and is a midwife, helping to deliver babies, helping women to let the babies get out, and helping the babies get out of the women. And she has great stories that all apply to what we're doing here, but one of them is a story about a birth that was starting. The woman was having labor. She had grown up on this commune with this woman who was the midwife. And she was totally informed about all of the tricks and all of the ways to make it easy and not to get into negativity, send everyone in the room love, it's just power, it's not pain, etc. Sometimes they'll say, well, it was a little painful, but it was really strong, but it wasn't strong. And they're not lying. Sounds weird, but they're not lying. And at a certain point, everything was going well and quickly, and suddenly everything stopped. And I don't remember how many hours, but it was at least 17 hours that it just stayed like that. Her husband is there supporting her, totally with her, helping her to be relaxed. The midwife is there, the helper is there, the friend is there, whatever. So at least 17 hours. I mean, I can't imagine. Eventually, something happened and the baby came out. Round two, second baby. They were talking with the midwife, the husband, and the mother. And they realized that maybe what happened in the first birth was at exactly, maybe by coincidence, but exactly at the moment that the opening process for the mother and the baby stopped, froze, exactly at that moment, the father, who is supporting the mother on his lap, had to pee and held the pee for 17 hours. So the rule was, don't, no one hold your pee. The second birth was really easy. So, I'm not saying to run to the bathroom every time. But some kind of place inside us. One writer that I just love that someone here gave me the book years ago, and I just love this book, A Life of One's Own. And she talks about an inner gesture. And if we could make this inner gesture that has something to do with it's okay to be. Whatever else is going on, it's okay to be. We could take it one step further, it's okay to be here. Or even, it's okay to be here together. Sometimes people have mentioned on this retreat and others, sometimes I feel like laughing, but I don't want to break the silence. And we say, laughter doesn't break the silence. And sometimes people say, I'm in the hall and I feel like crying, but I don't want to break the silence. Sometimes if we would feel free to laugh or to cry or to be, then it's like the sphincter law. Across the tent, people start feeling it's okay to be. What if it's okay to be? It starts dawning on us across the room. Sometimes we feel that caring, like this father of the child-to-be with the mother, with his wife. He wanted to support her, so he didn't go and pee. We don't want to bother the other people. And so we don't be. And we could easily spend our whole lives not wanting to bother anyone. And holding it. With the best intention. Sometimes if we have permission to laugh or cry, it doesn't feel so urgent also to laugh or to cry. The pressure is off. Sometimes if we feel and we see and we hear other people just being themselves, which means sometimes laughing, sometimes crying, we can stop having the impression that everyone else is so together. Or so something, but solid. Always smiling. Always negative. Never speaking. Never crying. If we can look past the shop window, then it might be easier for us to give ourselves that permission to do what needs to be done, including go and pee. Someone probably really has to pee now. And so maybe some of that embarrassment about just being could either be lessened or funny. And funny would be better. Better even than taking the edge off that embarrassment would be letting the embarrassment be so clear to us that we can just laugh. One of my teachers that I've only met in books, a Tibetan one, talks about the moment that the Buddha was it supposedly under this tree, probably just looking at the one leaf that no one thought to write down. But he said, I'm going to sit here until I get enlightened, even if my body turns to dust and blows away in the wind. And someone says, doesn't that sound a little heavy? And this teacher says, exactly, this is the peak, the most refined version of feeling lack and thinking something outside of me is going to make me finally as perfect and solid and together as the others are. And so we're letting ourselves see our situation, that even the Buddha was doing something so ridiculous right before getting enlightened. I mean, so ridiculous. So we also do something so ridiculous. And the teacher even says, as we become more adjusted to living so openly and feeling so raw, and tender, as we allow more and more wisdom to come through, as we allow ourselves not to try to hide in an idea of the truth, but we allow that unsolid, very alive, wild animal to come through, then these silly things that we do are going to become even more silly. So these obstacles are going to become even more clever. The more refined the meditation is, the more refined, the more difficult, the more clever, the more hard to catch the thing called obstacle. In this case, the doubt about whether he could reach enlightenment. So then he had to say, I will, no matter what. Turn me to dust. So daring to see. This is actually the meaning of vipassana. Daring to see through the emperor's clothes. Vipassana means to see behind or from behind. And this can be an interesting game to play with. To see behind in myself or other people or a leaf. And to see from behind if there's a difference. And if If so, what is the difference? And this could be a kind of a safeguard, so that if I'm trying to see, and there's harshness in that trying to see, if there's escape from the messiness of life in trying to see clearly, then I can also try to see from behind. And the sharpness can't stay there. Or if I'm really happy trying to see from behind in my inner process, let it also come out in seeing. Seeing through. Seeing behind. Seeing through the shop window. Even of a leaf. Remembering that not only for humans, but certainly for humans, to be forcefully exposed would be one of the worst experiences we could possibly have. And has been, for some of us, the worst experience we've ever had. So not to use force, but still to dare. To see. And to see through, or behind, and from behind. And it's not that this is a comfortable and steady place to sit. There's nowhere to sit there. And still we can sit there. I feel that we have to, and I wouldn't normally like to use these words, and I don't actually even now like to use these words, but I feel we have to become accustomed to the power that is available sitting in that no place, seeing through, being seen through. The power where it may be I'm seeing anger and I just see it as it is, and its power. It's not my story. Or I just see the leaf, and it's not a leaf. That power we don't like to sit on, in, with, through, etc. But we have to. I think it's kind of urgent. But it's such a raw place to be that we really also, if we're going to sit there in that no place, we also have to take care of each other. Not to be embarrassed to take care of each other. I found one time when I read that Hafiz poem, you feel cold, so I reach for a blanket to cover our shivering feet. You feel hungry, and I start digging potatoes in my own garden. And you feel lonely, so I tie a rope around me and give it to you. I remember being in a situation where this was the case. This was describing the situation. With an actual me and an actual person. An outer situation. And that person was an ex-partner. And this was like an impossible and embarrassing situation. No one can accept this. We only feel permission, and we don't even feel permission, to treat a lover like that. You feel hungry, so I go to my garden and dig potatoes. We take that as an insult or humiliation. If we see a friend doing that, we say, whoa, be careful, watch out. Don't be used. And Mirabai wasn't saying, be used and let someone dress you. Like a Barbie or whatever. But we need that power to to come through us. And sometimes we say naked power or raw power in English to mean basically too much power. Too much power, the mind will say, this is too much. And the mind will be right. From the mind's point of view, it is too much. But that's only the mind's point of view. The mind will say, this is too much. But if it's not a person using me as part of a game, but by being used, the individual feels so happy and energized and relaxed. Sphincter law. Relaxed. Then, maybe too much is good in this case. Maybe we have to rearrange the rules that we have, the norms that we have about human behavior. There's something that I call a love bomb. And when there's a love bomb, there's a feeling of being, oh yeah. All my friends have been waiting for me at this table with wine and guitars. And I belong here. And the power of the love bomb, it's not that it's more powerful in the way that we know power than a regular bomb, but it is more powerful in reverse, kind of, than a nuclear bomb. I do think it's about time. But to be very clear, I just end with one image about this power. After the atom bomb in Hiroshima, destruction where all that was left to someone was their shadow, where their body protected the earth from the heat, and then the body completely disappeared in the heat. Destructive bomb. That was in August. And the very next springtime, everything was black. The very next springtime. And no one knew what was going to happen, because this was the first time in this kind of way that this bomb had been dropped on people and cities and gardens and so on. And the very next springtime, the cherry trees, which are a really important, gorgeous, appropriate symbol in Japanese culture, they come and they're just almost invisible. They're so thin and light and they blow on the wind. And the cherry blossoms the very next spring after the bomb came back. The trees blossomed. So this is what is possible with trees. And I just wonder what is possible with us, who have also been hurt and burned and disappeared. If we could find a way of coming back that's not dressing ourselves, I think it would be good. Hard and good. Our union, our intimacy, our nakedness to each other is like this. You feel cold, so I reach for a blanket to cover our shivering feet. So let's have time for walking and personal interviews for those who like. And just enjoying being here.